You're listening to a program produced in 2011 as part of Aloud, a series of dynamic lectures, readings, performances, and discussions that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic downtown Central Library in the heart of L.A. These programs are presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, which supports the Los Angeles Public Library. To learn more about Aloud, please go to our website, www.aloudla.org. Jared Diamond began his scientific career in physiology and expanded into evolutionary biology and biogeography. About his landmark Pulitzer Prize-winning work, Guns, Germs, and Steel, he noted, "I've set myself the modest task of trying to explain the broad pattern of human history on all the continents for the last 13,000 years. Why did history take such different evolutionary courses for people of different continents?" Jared Diamond is professor of geography at the University of California, Los Angeles. His other books include Collapse, How Societies Choose to Fail or Succeed, and The Third Chimpanzee, and Why is Sex Fun? Among his many honors are a MacArthur Foundation Fellowship. His field experience includes 17 expeditions to New Guinea and neighboring islands to study ecology and the evolution of birds, and he's also known for his rediscovery of New Guinea's long-lost golden-fronted bowerbird, a quite extraordinary creature. In his new two-volume study, the first of which has been published just now, The Origins of Political Order, Francis Fukuyama notes that it takes only a couple of hours to fly from Port Moresby, Papua New Guinea's capital, to Brisbane, Australia. But in that flight, one is in some sense traversing several thousand years of political development. How did any society, he asks, make the transition from a tribal to a state-level society? And to answer that Uber question, Fukuyama, trained as a historian, uses material from anthropology, economics, and biology, looking across time and space in a comparative fashion. Francis Fukuyama is the Olivier Nomolini Senior Fellow at the Center on Democracy, Development, and the Rule of Law at Stanford University. He's written widely on issues relating to democratization and international political economy. His book, The End of History and the Last Man, was published in 1992 and has appeared in over 20 foreign editions. His most recent books are America at the Crossroads, Democracy, Power, and the Neoconservative Legacy, and Falling Behind, Explaining the Development Gap Between Latin America and the United States. It is a great honor to welcome two great thinkers to the Los Angeles Public Library. Please welcome Jared Diamond and Francis Fukuyama. Thank you.
There you go first. Let me first check whether I'm loudspeakered and you can hear me okay. Yeah. I'll begin by saying that this evening is a great pleasure for me because I've, of course, known of Francis's work for a long time, but this is the first time that we meet, and it turns out that we're kindred spirits in many respects. Our shared points include that we're interested in writing books about large questions of history. Both of us have current books. Francis has published, and mine still a year and a half off, current books on tribal societies evolving into states. Both of us majored in classics, Francis at university, I at high school. Both of us read Russian, ancient Greek, Latin, and Spanish. Both of us have two sons, one of mine being here this evening. Both of us have been involved in UCLA and RAND. Both of us put New Guinea into the prefaces of our books. There are, of course, differences, one of them being that Francis has a daughter and I don't. And there are other differences in our experiences and points of view. But nevertheless, for me, it's a discovery to find how much we share in common besides our large books, and this is a great pleasure for me. I'd like to begin, Francis, by asking if you would tell us what it was that got you interested in political science and big history. I can say that I got interested in birds at age 7. Did you get interested in political history at age 7? And how was it that you ended up majoring in classics?
Well, I had a career where I guess you could describe the entirety of it as never having figured out what I was going to major in. And in some sense, that's still the case. In college, I was a classics major because I wanted to do political philosophy to read Plato and Aristotle, which is why I learned Greek. And after a misstep into postmodernist, comparative literature, I went back to political science because I thought that, this was the late 1970s. There are big issues having to do with the Cold War and, international conflict, and that I wanted to, in a sense, move away from the humanities into something that was very practical. Since then, I've actually decided that the general question of development, how societies change over time, is the most fascinating, big problem that I can wrap my mind around. In a certain sense, The End of History was a book about development, except that I just didn't know enough history when I wrote that, and so I'm now making a second stab at it. And I think American foreign policy is actually pretty easy, or international relations, to understand the basic concepts and what's going on. Development is far more difficult because it's, as you well know, highly interdisciplinary, and it requires crossing a lot of boundaries and going into a lot of, unknown territory.
Both of us have faced issues of working in multiple disciplines and also working in multiple areas. You are not one of those scholars who's a specialist on the third year of the American Civil War. Instead, you're interested in comparisons, and one phrase that you quoted from someone else struck me. You commented, "He who knows only one country knows no countries." And I wondered if you could give an example of situations where you've learned a lot from the power of comparisons and whether you've taken flack from historians who resent someone who knows about the third year of the American Civil War talking about the second year, no less the Spanish Civil War, no less the Roman Civil War.
Well, the quote, "He who knows one country knows no countries," comes from one of my other mentors, Seymour Martin Lipset, the great sociologist, who was also a great comparativist. He wrote a book called American Exceptionalism. That was one of his concerns in life. And he said Americans don't understand how peculiar their own institutions are. The degree of anti-statism, for example, the degree of distrust of government that is bread and butter, we have a Tea Party now that is built around distrust of government. It's a perfectly normal part of American politics. The fact that we have so many checks and balances in our constitutional system seems natural. They don't understand that in England, which also is a parliamentary democracy, budgets are passed within a week of being presented to Parliament, because basically you've got a Westminster system where there are no, if you've got a majority in Parliament, you just pass the budget and that's that. It's kind of a democratic dictatorship. And so I think that that's, really where I first began to realize that you've got an awfully parochial danger of being awfully parochial if you are too concentrated. And of course, that means trespassing and getting all of the specialists really annoyed at you because they think they own these particular subjects. But I do think that there's a real point in doing this very large comparison. Like in your work, I don't think that you could have demonstrated the power of physical geography to affect social outcomes if it hadn't been, so completely broadly comparative on a world scale. And I think there's as much need for that level of generalization as I think there is for the specialized knowledge.
That's true. As you look around the world at agricultural systems, because we both recognize that agriculture was an important development in human history, permitting population explosion, etc., it's instructive to look at different agricultural systems. You comment on the New Guinea agricultural system. New Guinea was one of the nine homelands of agriculture, but New Guinea did not produce state government. And it's an instructive agricultural system because it was one that lacked domestic animals, and it had, apart from the U.S. Southeast, the narrowest range of crops, mm-hmm. and it didn't have a a crop that could be stored in the long run so it didn't produce food surpluses that could feed chiefs and bureaucrats. Mm-hmm. So New Guinea, the comparison with New Guinea was instructive for me, and the comparison of the U.S. Southeast was instructive. A comparison that's very interesting for us here in Los Angeles is, within the New World, the comparison between the current state of Latin America and North America. So North America has two countries, the United States and Canada, and both of those countries are about three times richer on a per capita basis than the richest country of Latin America. People from Latin America ask themselves, so why is it that Latin America turned out poorer than North America and with less government stability? It's a big comparative question of history. What would you say about that comparison?
Well, there are a number of economists who think that it's all a matter of material resources, that the big Spanish, the basis of the Spanish Empire was extracting gold and silver in Mexico and Peru, and that's what created this hierarchical, basically slave-based system that persists to this day, whereas North America was settled by family farmers that were not part of this larger hierarchical system. I think that that's true to some extent, but it doesn't explain Argentina, for example. Argentina is temperate. It's basically like the Midwest. It's a big breadbasket, and it was all settled by Italians and Spaniards. And you know, they killed off all the indigenous people very early. What's Argentina's excuse for looking the way it does, with its constant inflation, civil wars, you know, coups, and so forth? And in my view, this is the argument. I have a chapter on the Spanish legacy in the New World. Spain was an interesting country because at the time, you know, when the Spaniards invaded or tried to invade England, everybody regarded the Spanish king as an absolute monarch with Turk-like powers. But it turned out that he was actually very weak. The Spanish government declared bankruptcy from the time of Charles V, the great Habsburg emperor, in the early 1500s up until Philip IV in the 17th century. They declared bankruptcy on probably 12 to 15 occasions, and they did this because they could not tax their own elites. They were enmeshed in a system of law that protected basically rich people, and the only way that the Spanish king could raise money was by essentially selling public offices. And so he'd sell the position of general or the tax collector of a particular town or the mayor of another town to wealthy private individuals. And this is a system, they tried to avoid transmitting this system, this highly corrupt system, to the New World, but ultimately it didn't work. And so by the end of the 18th century, you had these very unequal societies established in which you had relatively small oligarchic elites of, you know, the elite of Creole settlers, some of them in places like Bolivia, sitting on large indigenous populations, and that system has reproduced itself. The inequality, I think, is one of the big obstacles to, you know, to economic growth, because every generation or so you get a Hugo Chavez or some leader that, you know, represents the interest of the outs or the, you know, the have-nots, and it sets the entire society back.
Mm-hmm. What you say about Argentina, in fact, it's even more striking when you reflect that the three southernmost countries of South America, which are the countries in the temperate zone, most nearly comparable to the United States and Canada, are Argentina, Chile, and Uruguay. And those three countries are, on a per capita basis, the richest countries of Latin America, mm-hmm. Illustrating that there's a geographic role along with the huge cultural role. Other cases where you've mentioned the legacy of the past. So in Latin America, we see a big legacy of the past because it was colonized by the Spanish. That's had consequences until today. Mm-hmm. And Hispaniola, part colonized by the French, part mm-hmm. colonized by the Spanish, resulting in the big differences that we see today mm-hmm. between Haiti and the Dominican Republic.
I believe, doesn't one of your books have a photograph of the dividing line between the Dominican Republic and Haiti, and it's all deforested on one side and, you know, lush jungle on the other?
It's an incredible border. If you take the plane flight from Miami to Santo Domingo, and you fly over this island, it looks as if it's been cut by a knife because there's this line, and it's brown on one side, that's Haiti, and it's green on the other side. You emphasize in quite a few places in your book the role of history, that institutions that developed and ideas that developed have long-lasting consequences. Again, one of your remarks that struck me was a paradox that you point out. You express it something like, political liberty requires a strong government. Now, that seems to be a contradiction. One might think political liberty requires a weak government. But no, you argue that political liberty requires a strong government, and you mentioned the comparison between England and Hungary. Could you tell us about that paradox?
Oh, well, I'm sure this audience is familiar with medieval Hungary, that story. I do think, as I was saying earlier, that Americans in particular have a very strong anti-statist tradition, for good reasons. We don't like concentrated power, and we think of liberty as freedom from coercion by the central government. But I think what you see in the course of human history is that freedom can be threatened by a lot of different sources, including local elites, local oligarchs, power holders that can be just as oppressive as central governments. And I think in the course of the development of states, one of the functions and one of the ways that states had of legitimating themselves was by protecting ordinary people against the barons, against the powerful. The English king, actually, that's why you got English cities, was he saw that cities were a good counterweight against all of these local power holders. So the specific issue with England and Hungary. In the 13th century, you signed the Magna Carta in England. The barons forced a constitutional settlement on King John. At almost the same time, the Hungarian nobility forced the Golden Bull on the Hungarian King Andrew, a constitutional limitation of the king's power. Hungary ended up being conquered first by the Mongols and then completely swallowed up by the Ottomans. England went on to become a parliamentary democracy. If all you need to protect liberty is a strong, armed civil society that defends itself from this powerful state, why didn't Hungary succeed? And the reason is the Hungarians, they went too far. They didn't have a state. When the Hungarian civil society took over, the Diet took over, first thing they did is they reduced taxes on themselves because they didn't want, these burdensome taxes, and they dismantled the army that the king had set up, and that paved the way for their eventual conquest. And in our history, you think about the role of the federal government. Freedom for African Americans did not spontaneously evolve simply by having a weak federal government. It first needed a civil war, a very bloody, 600,000 Americans killed, and then the actions in the civil rights period in the 1960s of a strong central government being willing to enforce the Constitution against local power holders in the society. So I believe that liberty is neither just a strong society nor just a strong state. It has to come out of the balance between the two. And if both of them are weak, you're also in trouble.
That's a very interesting idea. And of course, it goes contrary to an increasing trend in the United States today, which is that it appears to me that particularly more conservative people view liberty as freedom from government interference, and the ideal that they see is a market economy, that a market economy ought to operate unfettered by the government. It's ironic and paradoxical. It's also, in terms of history, scary, because when you look at the polarization in the United States that's been growing within the last decade and the increasing extent to which wealthier people and more powerful people are able to insulate themselves from consequences of their actions, if you look to the past societies in which the elite could insulate themselves from the consequences of their actions include the Maya kings and others, and it's a recipe for disaster.
Yeah, it is. I think, we Americans are fortunate because we can take the existence of a strong government that can enforce laws for granted. And then we have this luxury of saying, oh, the government, you know, causes all this trouble, or it's so incompetent or counterproductive. But if you want a society where the government doesn't bother you very much, you should go to Somalia, because you know you can and you can own not just an assault rifle, but an RPG or a shoulder-fired anti-aircraft missile, it's not a very pleasant society to live in. The other historical parallel that I worry about in the United States is the one of old regime France. Again, we think of this as a big absolutist, centralized power. But in fact, it was corrupt to the core, and it was corrupt based on tax exemption. The reason that France didn't develop parliamentary democracy the way England did is that the French interpreted liberty as privilege. Like, if I can take care of myself and my children by cutting a deal with the government to get myself a tax exemption, that's fine, and I'm not going to worry about anyone else. And the French progressively sold off virtually every public office in the society to wealthy individuals. And by the time of the revolution, the whole public sector was essentially the private property, and literally the private property. You could, if you got the role of finance minister, you could turn that office over to your son as part of his family inheritance. And part of the delegitimization that took place there was the fact that you'd essentially by this mechanism privatized the public space. There wasn't any public space where people were just interested in common good or public issues. It had all, in a sense, been outsourced to private interests.
One other area where you talk about this issue of liberty versus government control, and you discuss it a lot and with a lot of insight, involves China. And this gets into one of the questions that one often hears people asking, namely, is a centralized dictatorship more effective than a democracy at solving problems? And one often hears a centralized dictatorship praised for its ability to make quick, efficient decisions. One hears China cited in this connection, and one thinks of quick, efficient decisions that China made, such as deciding within 1 year to get lead out of gasoline. So the government decided it. In 1 year, lead was out of gasoline in China. In the United States, it took at least a decade and lawsuits, or again, the end of old growth logging in China. In the United States, we haven't ended old growth logging. In China, there were the floods of, what was it? There was 1 year in the, I think, 1990s when there were massive floods on hillsides that had been deforested that displaced hundreds of millions of people. And the Chinese government decided that's enough, no more old growth law. And in 3 months, end of old growth logging. So people often say, doesn't this illustrate that a centralized dictatorship is the most effective form of government? There are some holes in that reasoning, but what would you say about that?
Well, actually, it is a central theme in the book because I talk about the emergence of different kinds of political institutions in China and in the West and other parts of the world. I think there are three critical ones. So one is the state itself. So this is the ability to make decisions, enforce rules, and concentrate power. But you also have the rule of law, which makes sure that the state obeys the law and doesn't just make up rules as it goes along. And then finally, mechanisms of accountability to make sure that the state actually serves the interest of the citizens and not just its own interests. And what I think is the biggest difference between Chinese and European development is that the Chinese got the first of these down really, really early, not just creating a state, but creating a modern state in the sense that the emperor just didn't hire his cousins and friends to run the government. They invented this Mandarin examination system by which you recruited people ruthlessly on the basis of merit, and you administered bureaucratically an enormous empire that at the time of Caesar Augustus was 60 million people, as large as the Roman Empire, through uniform, centralized laws. But they didn't have rule of law. There's never been rule of law in China in the sense of a higher law that constrains the will of the emperor. And of course, there's no democracy except now in Taiwan. And so in Europe it was different because you started with rule of law. that was actually the first set of institutions in the Middle Ages. And then you tried to create a state in a society that already was law-abiding. And then at the end of that, you added institutions of accountability. So you've got checks and balances, you know, the checks imposed both by law and by procedural accountability, like things like elections. And as you say, the Chinese, in that kind of system, without those checks and balances, can, I mean, you can multiply your examples, you know, high-speed rail now. They've got this everywhere in China. They're knitting together, you know, the entire country. And, you know, look at California. I mean, my city of Palo Alto is still dead set against, you know, having high-speed rail in its backyard because, you know, we live in a democracy. But I still, in the long run, bet on the system with checks and balances because there are a number of things, a number of reasons why this should be true. The Chinese have a kind of ruthless upward accountability to the, you know, in dynastic times it was to the emperor, now it's to the Chinese Communist Party, and they hold officials responsible. But there's no downward accountability. There's no independent media. There are no local elections. You can't get rid of your local party boss, who in China is often in cahoots with the developers and highly corrupt. And then the biggest problem, I think, is what the Chinese have typically called the bad emperor problem, which is the fact that when you've got, you know, a good emperor, like, you know, all these examples you cited, they make good decisions, they do it much more quickly than a democracy with all of the checks and balances and need for consensus. But when you've got a bad emperor, you know, watch out, because there's really no way to get rid of this person. And in Chinese history, there are a number of really notable bad emperors, including the first Qin Shi Huangdi, the first emperor that unified China. You know, the Terracotta Warriors were part of his mausoleum. The movie Hero, the Jet Li movie Hero, was really about him. He was a megalomaniac who instituted a very harsh dictatorship. He didn't like the carping of Confucian scholars, so he dug a big pit and threw 400 of them in and buried them alive, and to this day is execrated by, you know, the traditional Confucians. Another one, my favorite one in the book, was the evil Empress Wu, whose story is really compelling because she was the only woman in Chinese history, in dynastic history, who established a dynasty in her own name as opposed to ruling through one of her sons or her husband. And the way she got into power, she was a concubine of the second Tang emperor. She got rid of the empress by having her own daughter have an audience with the empress and then be smothered. And the death was blamed on the empress, and then the emperor got rid of her and replaced her with Wu Zhao, this concubine. She managed to kill a couple of her sons to get them out of the way as obstacles to her power. And then she killed off a very large part of the Tang nobility that stood in the way, was very resentful of this upstart woman. And, you know, she, again, is classified as one of the bad emperors. And the last one that existed was Mao Zedong, you know, who unleashed this horrendous cultural revolution, the Great Leap Forward, killed millions of Chinese. And so that's the problem they haven't solved. You know, they've gotten the good government part of it when they've got this good emperor, but no one has designed a system for guaranteeing that you always have good emperors.
You've got good examples from the past, and you're correct that that basic problem of China operates in the present. Yes, one can point out the good decisions that the current Chinese government has made, but then, yes, they can make quick, efficient decisions. There's no system, though, that guarantees that more of those decisions will be good and fewer of them will be bad than in a democracy. So in the United States, in the state of California, despite what the government of California is doing now, California is not going to succeed in closing down a system of higher education. You can't do that in a democracy. But in China, it was possible to close down the system of higher education for more than a billion people. So that's the bad emperor phenomenon in the present.
I don't want to make you pose all the questions, so can I pose a question to
Please.
You? Well, so, you know, one of the big issues that I deal with, but you certainly deal with in your book, is, you know, the general comparison between the West and China, and why you get highly concentrated power in, you know, the Yellow River, Yangtze River valleys, and, you know, a very different system arising in Western Europe. And I would say that you have a, you know, a pretty strong geographical argument, but I thought, I mean, that's actually an area where we probably overlap and would agree, but I wonder if you might talk about that a little bit.
Sure, that's a big question on which your views probably overlap partly, but not entirely, with mine. It can be summarized as the why China question. Things about China. So why, given the early origins of agriculture, and as you say, the first modern state in China, why was it Europeans rather than Chinese who expanded over the world? And why was it Europe rather than China that industrialized? Or another facet of the same question, why was China unified so early and why has it stayed unified? You have a wonderful figure in which you trace the various Chinese unifications and empires and their falling apart. If China had been unified once and then fell apart, you could say, well, that's an accident. But as you point out, China got unified 221 BC, and eventually it falls apart. And then it reunifies, and it stays unified for a couple of centuries. And then it falls, and then it gets reunified. So there have been a whole, China, whenever it falls apart, has gotten reunified. Whereas in the case of India, the Indian subcontinent, India was partly unified three times, and each time it fell apart quickly. So why is China so easily unified? Because I'm a professor of geography, I would have to say it's because of geography. Both you and I are interested in chains of causation, and I see at the bottom of the chain of causation the bedrock of geographic factors. Just picture the map of China and compare it with the map of Europe. The map of Europe, there's the Greek peninsula, and there's the Italian peninsula, and there's the Iberian peninsula, and then there's the Danish peninsula, and there's the Scandinavian peninsula, and then there's this big island, England, and Ireland, and then there are the mountains that divide up Europe, and then the rivers of Europe flow radially, so the Rhone goes this way, and the Rhine goes this way, and the Seine goes this way, and the Elbe goes this way, and the Danube goes this way. Now compare the map of China. The coastline is smooth. There isn't a huge peninsula like Italy. There isn't a big island for China. Taiwan is smaller, I think, even than Ireland. The two big rivers of China, they flow parallel, and the land between them is sufficiently low that they were connected by canals a couple of thousand years ago. So, and the mountains, you don't have the equivalent of the Pyrenees and Alps dividing up China. So it seems to me that everything about the geography of China predisposed China to get unified early, and every time it fell apart, it got put together again. Whereas Europe, even military geniuses like, and administrative geniuses like Augustus and Charlemagne, and Napoleon and Hitler, nobody has been able to put together Europe permanently. And I see that as due ultimately to Europe's geography contrasting with China's geography. Mm-hmm. What do you think?
I agree. Everything you said, I think is right. I think that that's, you know, in a way, the development of free institutions in Europe was very much the result of that physical geography, because no single empire could unify the entire space of Europe. You had competition, which I think, you know, you have stressed repeatedly in many of your writings, and without that competition, you wouldn't have had the same incentives for innovation, and you wouldn't have had the growth of you know, centralized dictatorship the way you did. But so my next question, though, is India, right? So India is in a way like very much like Europe. It is never unified except briefly during the Maurya dynasty under Ashoka, and then under the Guptas, and then finally it's up to foreign conquerors like the Mughals or the British. But even they never succeed really in unifying the entire subcontinent. And so they're kind of the complementary opposite, whereas the default condition of China is to be a unified society. The default condition of India is to be a bunch of squabbling, you know, states periodically unified. The Gangetic Plain is big, got big rivers, lots of alluvial agriculture. What's the geographical reason why India never developed, a powerful Chinese-like society.
I can only speculate, and I do have to speculate because 2 weeks from next Tuesday, I'm going to have to lecture about this to my UCLA undergraduates about India. So why India? Whereas China was so easy to unify, India was so hard to unify. And when it got unified, it quickly fell apart. There are a couple of things distinctive about the geography, the biogeography, and the human geography of India. Biogeographically, India is the most complicated part of the world. India is the only place in the world where three major biogeographic regions approach each other. So you get the so-called Palearctic, Northern Eurasia, bordering the Oriental region in the Himalayas. But in addition, the Ethiopian region, the African region, comes into Southern Arabia. So India is the only place in the world where three biogeographic regions with three different faunas and three different ecologies providing three different sets of human subsistence mechanisms come together. But in addition, why the caste system in India? Why India uniquely in the world has the thousands of castes? Well, India is also the most diverse place in the world visibly for humans. There's no part in the world, no other place in the world where people look so differently as in India. In Northeast India, you get people related to Chinese, you get people related to Europeans coming in from the Northwest, you get Dravidians, and then you get Australian Aboriginal-like hunter-gatherer. So you get people, and in India, you can look at someone, and they're very different. So in India, you can put people into castes by their physical appearance. There's no other part of the world where people are so easy to pigeonhole by physical appearance. Mm-hmm. So my guess is that it's that enormous visible human diversity that made it possible to develop a caste system in India, but nowhere else in the world. And it's that biogeography that provided so many different subsistence mechanisms that allowed hunter-gatherers and pastoralists and estuarian fishermen and freshwater fishermen to live together and to have different economies within a small area. That's the best sense that I can make of India. But you have a lot interesting to say about India in your book. You've got several chapters on it, and I'm sure you've been to India more than I have. Why do you think India has been... In fact, you talk about the role of the Brahmins. Could you mm-hmm. expand on that?
Yeah, okay, good. So we found an area where we may disagree, because I think that... I just don't think that these geographical and material factors can really explain India without reference to ideas, and particularly religious ideas. There's this long conflict in the social sciences, whether material economic circumstances produce ideas. So this was Karl Marx's view, right, that religion was just a fairy tale that the dominant classes made up to justify their own rule, or that you could trace back religious ideas to some material self-interest. And then there's Max Weber, who turned that on his head and said, no, it's actually the religious ideas that actually create the social order. Capitalism wouldn't have existed without ascetic Protestantism that legitimated the endless accumulation of money. I think in the Indian case, I just find it really, really hard to explain something like the caste system in these material terms, because there are a lot of diverse societies, there's a lot of societies where people look different, and they do not develop these very, very specific rules of behavior, for example, about religious pollution. And I think that, this is an insight I had when I started writing this part of the book, that if you accept the metaphysics of Hinduism, then all of that becomes instantly extremely understandable and rational. Hindu metaphysics begins with the idea that the visible reality that we see around us is not the real reality, that there's a higher transcendent reality that we will get to in subsequent lifetimes. And in fact, we want to get away from the material reality, particularly related to excrement, dead bodies, dirt, all of the physical encumbrances of life. And the Brahmins, the twice-born varnas or castes, are the ones that are furthest away from that material reality. And everything in Indian culture then makes sense. Why is it that a tanner or a grave digger is of so much lower social status than a Brahmin? And indeed, a Brahmin who presides over funerals is of lower status than a Brahmin that
does investitures of rajas. And if you try to trace all of this back to some geographical or material circumstance, I just think it's a fool's errand. It doesn't make any sense to come up with all of these very detailed social rules. But if you actually take the religious ideas seriously and you say, well, you know, they were created by human beings, it was a kind of original social fact that people believe that the world is organized in this fashion, then I think you can explain the social organization of India, you know, much more effectively than if you try to trace, you know, why don't they eat cows? Well, cow meat spoils. Well, actually, so does pig meat and a lot of other meats, you know. So I think you're just kind of limited if you limit yourself to those sorts of material explanations.
This is an argument that you made in your book in a form, again, that struck me, and I'd like to quote it. You wrote, "It is a fool's errand, as you said now, to try to relate the propositions of Brahmin religion in any detail to the specific economic and environmental conditions existing in northern India at that time when the Brahmin religion arose." And I guess this is an area where you and I would say that these are research programs that are still in process, and I'm betting on one research program, and you are betting on another research program. To me, I guess you would say that religion is an independent variable. And I would ask, all right, so why did the Brahmin religion arise in India, and why did it not arise in the Middle East, or why did it not arise in Mexico? I would like to see reasons other than random reasons why the Brahmin religion developed in India. And I see that as a research program on which I would bet, and you see another research program on which you would bet. Would that be a fair statement?
Yeah, it's certainly a research program. I think, though, the social scientific aspiration to come up with a theory of ideas is a pretty tall order, because I just think that human ideas have their own internal logic. And unless you understand them from the inside, you know, as the people that thought them understood the world, and then how the ideas then develop, you know, according to their own logic, you're not really going to... And in other words, if you don't do that and you're constantly trying to relate this back to some self-interest of the people that held these ideas, I just don't think it's, you know, you're really going to get a full appreciation of the complexity of the ideational world that we live in.
Let me make one more attempt, and this involves someone that you may have known, Donald Kagan, the great historian at Yale, who was dean or provost there and whom I met. So I had a lunch with Donald Kagan, and I asked him, so why on earth is it that Greece became so important, disproportionately important in world history? Why did democracy arise in Greece? Was this something random? Could democracy have arisen in Afghanistan? And Donald Kagan said, see, if you've been to Greece, you'll see it. It's such a desperately poor land. And look at that coastline, that indented coastline, and look at those mountains. Greece is carved up. Greece couldn't unify itself until finally the Macedonians unified Greece. So in Greece, critical thinking could thrive, because if someone in one city-state said something that the king there didn't like, the person moved 40 miles and you were in another city-state. So Kagan argued that the geography of Greece favored critical thinking, favored democracy, and therefore that Plato and Aristotle that got you into the classics could have developed only in Greece. Was this something that you argued with Donald Kagan, and what would you say to it?
Well, yeah, I think that takes you back to if you know one country alone, you don't know any countries. I mean, I suspect you can find other parts of the world that have very similar geographies to Greece that didn't develop, you know, Thucydides and Plato and Aristotle. In fact, it's kind of scary if you think about the fact that at its height, the citizen population of Athens was no more than, you know, maybe 40, 50,000 people, and they produced all of these world historical thinkers within a period of 100, 150 years. And here we are in the United States, and you know, we got 300 million people, and what do we have? We have Lady Gaga. I mean, it's you know, so there probably was something in the water. I mean, there are actually a lot of cases like this. Like Hungary is another one. You know, if you look at there was an incident where in the Manhattan Project, President Roosevelt was sitting around with Edward Neumann and Leo Szilard and Edward Teller, and they had all gone to the same gymnasium in Budapest, you know, these great foundational physicists, 20th century physicists. And so, you know, I think, again, it's just very hard. As a social scientist, when you get to something like that, you say, this is just an independent variable. We don't know what's causing it. We know it causes other things, but, you know, to actually come up with a scientific reason for why Budapest produced so many great, you know, physicists and musicians in this period, it's pretty tough.
Here was an area where, in your book, you discussed a phenomenon whose significance hadn't dawned on me, and where I thought you came up with a strong reason for it. And this was the phenomenon of military slavery in the Ottoman Empire and in the precursor to the Ottoman Empire. It hadn't dawned on me that this was an unusual way to run a state. Usually you run a state by having the slaves down at the bottom and the related power brokers at top. But you pointed out that in the Ottoman Empire, the army and the bureaucrats came from people who were boys who were gathered from the countryside and remained slaves. So as your expression was, a one-generation aristocracy. Since that's so fascinating, and since I burble the explanation, could you just tell people this fascinating stuff about military slaves?
Military slaves. Well, it's actually part of a larger class of phenomenon that I talk about in the book. The creation of a modern state is really, in a way, a long-term struggle against the family, because biologically we favor our kin, we favor genetic relatives. And in order to create a modern impersonal state where people are promoted on the basis of talent rather than relatedness, you've got to come up with these extraordinary mechanisms. And every society did this in a different way. The Ottomans and the Arabs had the most extreme version, where they would literally kidnap these children in the Balkans, these boys between the ages of 12 and 19. They'd bring them back, they'd train them, raise them as Muslims, and take them away from their families, and in the early days prohibit them from having wives and children of their own. The moment they had a kid, they were out of the bureaucracy, and the reason was you wanted to make them loyal to the state and not to their families, because any person with children, you know, thinks about their children first and how to promote the interest. That's the basis of nepotism and corruption. But it wasn't just the Ottomans that did this. That's the same reason the Byzantines and the Chinese used eunuchs, because they don't have children. The Catholic Church, under Gregory VII, this great pope in the 11th century, declared, they fought a big internal conflict called the investiture conflict in order to mandate the rule of celibacy of the priesthood. It's not a doctrinal issue in Christianity, although a lot of contemporary Catholics think that it is rooted in doctrine, but the Eastern Church allows priests to marry, so did the Protestants, so did the Catholic Church before the 11th century. The only reason that celibacy of the priesthood was mandated was you didn't want priests turning over their benefices or wanting to turn their benefices over to their children, because that was a source of corruption in the church, and you couldn't raise the moral authority of the church until it had eliminated corruption in its own ranks. And so all of these societies come up with these different strategies basically to get past this very basic human biological desire to favor your relatives.
I'm sure that we've given people here questions that they may want to ask, but before we come to questions, let me raise one final issue, and that is, what can we learn from history? Are the implications of history for our future? Can we learn from the mistakes and the successes of the past? You've worked on development, you've traveled around a lot. What useful have you learned from your own work or the work of other political scientists and historians that can be offered as lessons to developing countries so that formerly poor countries that are poorly governed can become rich countries that are well governed?
Well, that is the question, and it's a really tough one to answer because history is obviously very important. You cannot possibly understand the way a contemporary society works without understanding its history. You know, in modern China, every educated person has read The Romance of the Three Kingdoms, and there are all of these historical reference points that the Chinese understand, but if you don't have an awareness of that, you're just not going to understand, you know, their internal discussion. But the other problem is that history doesn't provide any clear-cut lessons for modern society, simply because conditions are so different from one society to another. And so anyone that's, and classic example was during the Suez Crisis, Anthony Eden, the British prime minister, said, we've seen this before, the rise of Adolf Hitler, if we don't stop Nasser, he's going to overrun Europe. And it wasn't, it was a historical lesson, but it wasn't a very good analogy. And it got the British and the French into a lot of trouble in 1956. And so there are just a lot of pitfalls. And so I think actually, unfortunately, one of the lessons of history is the more history you realize actually how context-specific everything is and how difficult it is to actually generalize. That being said, I think we both made a lot of generalizations in both of our books. I would, before we, I guess, open the floor up, I would like to point out that Professor Diamond, I ran an international development program when I was at Johns Hopkins, and you've had this enormous impact on thinking about contemporary development problems in places like the World Bank, because, I think prior to guns, germs, and steel, people said it's all just a matter of policy. We can decide tomorrow to put the right policies in place, and then, you'll turn, Guatemala into Canada. And I think that, among other things, people didn't notice that, the vast majority of underdeveloped, very poor countries are all in the tropics, and that the vast majority of rich, industrialized countries are all in temperate zones. And, there are these, geographical factors. The germs part of it is critical. Disease burdens have now become kind of standard discourse in the development field because of the realization that if you've got malaria, you're just not going to work as hard as if you're malaria-free, and you're not going to be productive and so forth. And I think that's one of the tremendous contributions, that your writing has made.
Well, thank you, and I'd also like to mention the contribution that your writing has made by pointing out the long hand of history. You've pointed out how China today cannot be understood unless you understand China 2,032 years ago, and that India today cannot be understood without understanding India in the past. Yet geography plays a role, but geography interacting with history. Would you like to say something, Francis, about our venue, about the library and the role of the Library Foundation, particularly in these times today when the state budget is being cut? Would you like to comment on that before we open up to questions?
Oh, well, funny you should mention that. I think that I think the greatness of the United States is that not everything comes from the beneficent hand of the government. And that we have a strong civil society and strong private institutions, and these institutions would not exist unless people actually contribute to them. And so, this is a wonderful evening and a wonderful event, and it's made possible by the library, so I encourage all of you to be members.
I would just add to that now more than ever, with public support for libraries dropping and in danger, the library in West Los Angeles, one of the libraries in Los Angeles where my sons got their books out, is already closed. Now, more than ever, we need private support for our libraries. And this is, in the long run, a life and death matter for American society. If we are going to have an uneducated workforce and an uneducated next generation, of course we are going to lose out in competition with China and Vietnam and lots of other countries. So in your own self-interest and in the interest of your children and grandchildren, support the library. I think that's a good final note. And my guess is that some of you may have either questions or you would like to state your enthusiastic agreement with everything that that we've said, and there are a couple of microphones around, so you may direct your comments at either of us, but please keep your comments, please keep your question short to a sentence or two so that other people can also ask questions.
I want to refer to what you said about the power of comparing, because you compare North America to South America. I come from Romania and I study theater theory here in Los Angeles. My question would be, because what happens in political terms in Romania now is more like the government and everything, what's happening for years in Romania, nobody compares what's in Europe or outside the world. But politicians try to figure things out just looking at what's inside the country, while the young generation and the critics of the government, they always compare what's happening in Romania to what's happening in the world. In such a moment, what's the power or the usefulness of comparing? Thank you very much.
Francis. Well, I think that actually the European Union has been really important in that part of the world because there's a big incentive to join the European Union, and the European Union has got all of these standards, you know, that are based on European, pan-European practices. And so every candidate member, including Romania, that wants to get in has got to look at its own institutions and say whether they measure up. And you're not going to get in unless, you... Well, okay, so this is the other problem with the European Union. There's a way in, and there's no way to kick people out. So if your institutions then deteriorate, or like the case of Greece, it turns out that you got in under false pretenses, you're kind of stuck. So it's a work in progress.
Question here. Comment.
Is this on? Okay. Thank you both very much for coming. It's really delightful to have you. There's a subject that's of particular interest to me, but... Okay, first I'd like to make a point of information. It is, of course, a hazard of being a generalist that you may not have every detail right. And in fact, the Hungarian high school students went to a number of different high schools within a range of about 5 miles. There's a wonderful essay by Jorgi Marx, who was a physicist, who goes into great detail. In fact, von Neumann and Wigner were at the same high school together, though they were both Jewish. It was an Episcopalian high school. And von Karman and Teller were at a different high school founded by von Karman, and the von was given to von Karman's father. The question, which is related to that, that I'm particularly eager to learn, if you have strong opinions or insights into when and where in history remarkable advances in science have taken place, and if there's anything that particularly ties those times and places together.
When and where in history have remarkable advances in science taken place? I can think of three high points. One, of course, is Greece. It's amazing what those 40,000 people in Athens and elsewhere in Greece and in the Greek colonies overseas, the disproportionate contribution that they made to modern science and mathematics. I have a college classmate who teaches geometry at University of California, Berkeley, and his textbook is Euclid. It's amazing, a textbook 2,300 years old, and Euclid got it all right for geometry. Greece was amazing in its contributions to science. During the Middle Ages, the Arab world played an important role not only in transmitting classical knowledge, but also in producing new science of its own. And then in modern times, Joel Mokyr has pointed out that during the Industrial Revolution, its rise in England is related to the harnessing of science, which had previously been a useless gentleman's pastime, to become positively useful, namely in the late 1700s and early 1800s. What jump-started the Industrial Revolution in England was scientific discoveries that became useful for power, for chemistry, for biology, and for medicine. So I would see those as the three highlights in the history of science. That's history of science, 2 minutes summary of history of science. Let's give someone else a chance.
I really enjoyed the interplay of your two disciplines, and I would like to ask you to comment on the current evolution of American society from the perspective of each of your disciplines.
Well, the China-America comparison is an interesting one, because I think that if I had to point to a single problem in American politics right now. We pride ourselves in having this system of checks and balances, constitutional checks and balances. But it's at a certain point, if you've got a highly polarized society, it means you can't make decisions. You can't make basic decisions. And I think that, you know, we've got a pretty obvious problem staring us in the face, you know, the long-term fiscal sustainability of, system, and a political class that, given these institutions, really doesn't seem to be up to really solving the problem. And so I think that, this is a case where we need to really, since I don't have a institutional fix that I think is acceptable that would get us around this, I'm a little cautious in putting this forward. But it does seem to me that we need to think through whether our political system is actually serving us well, given the kinds of challenges that we face now.
Yes, I was interested in your geographic theory comparing China with the development of Europe and England. And I was just wondering if you had any thoughts, and I'm sure you do, on the development or the geographic theory of the development or non-development within Africa.
Yes. That's something that I lectured on to my UCLA students last Tuesday. So why is it that Africa, the continent where humans have been the longest, 5 million years of the human lineage in Africa, 500,000 years of Homo sapiens in Africa, 50,000 years, 70,000 years of behaviorally modern Homo sapiens in Africa. If a head start counts for anything, Africa should be by far the richest continent, and Africa is the poorest continent. Africa has many things going against it, some geographic and some historical cultural. You mentioned that tropical countries tend to be poor. Africa is a sandwich with a big tropical core and two thin slices of temperate zone bread at either end. The richest countries in Africa are the 3 or 4 countries in the far south and the 5 countries in the far north. So Africa has the disadvantage of being the most tropical continent. Africa has the disadvantage south of the Sahara of having a late start on agriculture, not till 3000 BC. That means 5,000 years of agriculture in sub-Saharan Africa compared to nearly 10,000 years of agriculture in the Fertile Crescent. Africa has the disadvantage of having a north-south axis. It's hard for things to spread down a north-south axis. It's easy for them to spread along the east-west axis of Eurasia. Africa has tropical diseases. It has poor quality soils. Africa was burdened by its colonial history, which introduced explicitly exploitative institutions. And many African countries have the misfortune, they suffer from the paradoxical curse of natural resources. Namely, they have the misfortune to be rich in diamonds and oil and not in other things. And economists find that to have your economy disproportionately dependent on natural resources is a recipe for corruption and civil wars. So when I lectured to my students, I came up with 6... If you want a simple answer, this is the wrong question. There are these 6 factors that penalized Africa. Francis, would you like to add something to that?
No, I think that's a good answer.
We have another question back there.
Sorry if I misrepresent some of your points here, but you're talking about sort of what makes great or strong countries. And I wonder, you talk about resources, obviously, is very important, and also a strong government having the power to be able to kind of fight against people's own privatization and their own interest. It seems, though, that with those two, it depends, those give an opportunity for a strong government to form. But I'm wondering, how much does it depend on leadership, just being able to use those opportunities to the advantage of the company to actually bring about results?
Well, I don't know that leadership per se is the key factor. If you look at why you had the rise of states It's a complex a set of factors, many of which are geographical. I mean, if you don't have a kind of constrained area with plentiful resources, you're not going to get this powerful form of social organization. But the actual process of state formation in China and in Europe is driven by violence. The chapters in my book on the formation of the Chinese state goes through the history of ancient China in the spring and autumn period from about the 8th to the 5th century. These Chinese polities fought about 1,200 wars with one another. In the Warring States period, they fought about 450. The number dropped only because so many of the states had been annihilated in the earlier period that there are just fewer of them to fight wars. And then it finally all consolidates into a single state. And unfortunately, human nature being what it is, people do not have the incentives to get past nepotism and, you know, friends and family unless they're under a desperate struggle to create institutions really of power. And that's why you hire a general, for example, who's competent as opposed to one that's just your cousin. You know, President Lincoln had a lot of patronage appointments in the Union Army early in the Civil War because, you know, the U.S. government ran on patronage, and they lost a lot of battles. And so finally, by the end of the Civil War, they'd figured out what the Chinese had learned, 2,300 years earlier, which was that you need impersonal leadership based on, you know, talent and proven qualifications rather than friends and family.
We have a microphone back there.
Yes, I do. I'm just curious on something that may seem a little bit off topic, but I think we really need to understand, which is can we truly understand the world today without taking seriously what may be one of its most impactful cultures and the history and rise of it, which is essentially the culture of Hollywood and what it means. I mean, you mentioned Lady Gaga. I think we have to... I'm an anthropologist by training, and I've been really curious about the need to look at it in a more serious and really research-oriented way.
A bagatelle and epiphenomenon, what would you like to say? This is the longest silence since Memorial Day.
Yeah. Well, I honestly don't know what to say about that because, you know, Hollywood represents a lot of things. I mean, it's very American in so many ways, but it's also modern in a lot of ways, in ways that transcend, you know, just American culture, which is why it's popular everywhere. And so, you know, the kind of individualism, mobility, competitiveness of modern societies, it all gets reflected there. The one thing that strikes me watching Chinese versus American movies is that the American ones, even if they're violent and gross and whatnot, they've always got uplifting endings. Whereas in the Chinese ones, the bad guy oftentimes ends up winning, and you leave the movie theater saying, "Oh my God, you know, life is really awful." But I'm sorry, these are pretty superficial observations. So.
Some of you may want your book signed, want to chat with us. So let's just take one more question, and then we'll turn over to personal chatter and book signing.
I'd like to ask a question of Jared Diamond about the geography in the two places, or two of the places that our country is currently trying to impose a political system, Iraq and Afghanistan. Given that General Petraeus found a way to pacify Iraq by appealing to the Sunni elders, and has tried to impose that same system on Afghanistan. I wonder if you see a geographical difference between Iraq and Afghanistan that might impact on how successful or unsuccessful that strategy might be.
You won't be surprised that, yes, I discern geographical differences. Afghanistan is landlocked, which is a recipe for poverty. Afghanistan has never had unity beyond tribal unity. Iraq, in contrast, the first state in world history was in Iraq 5,400 years ago. The first writing in world history was in Iraq. Iraq has a seacoast. It was the center of origin of world agriculture and really of everything interesting in Western Eurasian civilization. The reason for the decline of, subsequent decline of Iraq and Western Eurasia is debated. It may be environmental. It may have been the effect of Mongol invasions. It may have been institutions. But yes, I see geographical differences between Iraq
and mountains. I mean, if you think about where are there surviving tribal societies, it is either heavily jungled, mountainous, or barren deserts, because that's where states can't project their power. And I think, you know, NATO is discovering that in Afghanistan as we speak.
We could also add that Iraq has oil and Afghanistan doesn't. And that last profound insight of mine may be a good note on which to close. We'd be happy to meet with you afterwards if any of you would like to.
Thank you.
Thank
you. Thank you very much.
Aloud Audio is produced by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles and made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, Righteous Persons Foundation, the National Endowment for the Arts, City National Bank, K&L Gates, KPMG, the Bujaki Foundation, Susan and David Rosenblum, Wallace Foundation, and Donna and Martin J. Wolfe. Media support provided by KPCC 83.9 FM and KUSC 91.5 FM. Additional support provided by the Council of the Library Foundation and individual Library Foundation members. Aloud theme composed by Larry Karish.